Podcast. I'm your host, Amandre Johnson. Glad to have you on episode 5. On this podcast, we discuss short stories of Black history of a person who lived through the time period. Here, we think it's important to carry on the stories of those that lived through the times, to understand a first-person perspective, and most of all, to continue the legacies and memories that are important to our future. Here today, we have Dr. Mathis. Please tell us your birth year and where you were born.
I was born in 1985 in the great city of Charleston, South Carolina.
Outstanding. All right, so what we're going to talk about today is the MOVE movement and the bombing of a neighborhood in Philadelphia. It is the year you were born, the year 1985 it happened. And Dr. Mathis here has done some great research with me here to talk through this. This is really relevant today because it has to do with the police brutality that's going on right now. And I think it's important to still discuss and, you know, analyze what's going on in the world today, as we did on our last podcast, episode 4. But we could start at this Teen Vogue article that I found. Super great article by Kim Kelly. She did an amazing job. To start off about MOVE, it was founded in 1972 by Vincent Leaphart. He was a Korean War veteran who took the name John Africa to show his love for the continent. The group's politics were anti-capitalist, anti-government, and anti-modern technology. It was all rooted in a 300-page document they called The Guidelines. I can tell you he lost me at anti-modern technology because the internet and the computer is a great thing.
But the thing about it is, he was illiterate. He was a functional illiterate. I read that on Wikipedia, which I know is going to give me, I know you're saying a doctor uses Wikipedia. Trust me, it's still used. But this guy was so dynamic and so charismatic. He convinced people, one, to change their last name to Africa. Everybody in the group changed their last name to Africa. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he dictated all his writings to a professor at Stanford. Dictated to him, he was able to move people, and he could not read.
Yeah. That ain't what you say, it's how you say it, I guess.
It's amazing. And what's funny is, like, when you look at, like, first of all, they were hippies. I found that out too. Basically, they took Black empowerment and mixed it with hippie ideology in the 80s. So mm-hmm. This is Reagan's America. Like, this is capitalist America that we're dealing with here. And he convinced them that flower power is the way to go.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because they were, Teen Vogue also wrote that they were originally called the Christian Movement for Life, and MOVE members considered themselves a family and were involved in animal rights activism. They embraced a raw food diet, natural home births, homeschooling, and composting. Ironically, they lived in like a very communal West Philadelphia row home, and I know those aren't everywhere, but they're like the houses that are like right next to each other. They're built tall. Very tight space, very, you know, city-like, and they often held public demonstrations against war, racism, and police brutality.
Well, they got more militant as they went forward. Like, when you look at, they start out, and they're they start getting guns around, I think, 79 is when mm-hmm. they actually lock up, and I'm sure you're going to talk about this, they lock up 9 of them over a dubious shooting of a police officer. Mm-hmm. Where they said that he was shot by friendly fire, but the police officers said that they were actually shot by the MOVE people. And so you get, as with a lot of these things, you get conflicting stories.
Yes.
And I think that's interesting with how this works. But the main thing you're getting ready to talk about, you can't conflict because everybody agrees on what happened with the bombing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's several stories about that. I mean, it was several different accounts. But you were right. Although they, you know, they started off claiming to be peaceful, no surprise, their neighbors hated them. They would often like hold protests like right outside in the neighborhood. They complained about the compost piles, and they would often like quote says, blasting profanity laced political diatribes through loudspeakers at all hours. So, you know, obviously the neighbors would call the police on them. And in 1977, members began to get gunned, declaring that they would no longer be beaten or intimidated by law enforcement. And there's a quote, I believe the police chief called him like a spine in his butt or something like that, because they were always, always in something, and the neighbors just constantly complained about him. Oh, here it is. Mayor Frank Rizzo issued an order for their eviction from their home at 311 North 33rd Street. He's quoted saying, "These people represent nobody but themselves. They're complete idiots." Rizzo told the press he had previously referred to the move as absolute imbeciles, psychotics, and not even human beings. That's a pretty bold statement for the mayor to say.
It is. And what's funny, I read an article about these, and it had basically, it was like an interview. It was basically statement from people who live near them. Mm-hmm. And it said that they were terrible neighbors. They hated living next to them. White and black folks said this. They hated living next to them. Because let's be real, would you want your child going to school every day walking by armed people in their yard?
Right.
The problem comes with how they chose to solve the problem of evicting them. That seems to be the biggest issue, is not did they deserve to be moved. It was, which brings us to kind of where we are today. It's not do you question whether a crime was committed. It's how you choose to enforce the arresting of those people.
Indeed.
Which seems to be the problem. Are we on 79 or 85 at this point?
We're at 77. We're moving on to 79, because that's is when they shot that police officer. They had came up. They had a standoff with police, and one police officer was shot. Seven other police, five firefighters, and three movementers, and also three bystanders were injured in this shooting. And also they said that the beating of Dobert Africa, was a member, was caught on video and, you know, became an infamous example of police brutality. Nine of those movement members who were in the house at that time got a sentence of 30 to 100 years in prison. All of them got charged for third-degree murder, which the craziest part is no one ever is really sure who shot the cop. And some say that the cop was shot by friendly fire.
Yes. I read the same thing. It was like, you know, they weren't sure because they, according to the police, because the man was shot in the back of the head. He was in the front. The police say he turned around and was shot by somebody from inside the building. Uh-huh. Move members claim he was shot by shots being fired in. Also, I just can't believe that police were okay, knowing how kind of the rules of engagement are now, that people were okay firing on what is essentially an inner city street into a building.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it gets worse. Oh, yeah.
Like, keep in mind, these people, this is in the inner city of Philadelphia. This is not like off in Ruby Ridge, Idaho, or any of those kind of places. This is a armed standoff in the middle of a major American city.
In an everyday neighborhood. Full working, like, busy neighborhood. It's crazy.
Well, also, they said that neighborhood, part of what Moose's problem was, they moved into the wrong neighborhood. They did not move into a quote-unquote slum area. They moved into a middle-class, like, working-class, not suburb, a working-class neighborhood inside Philadelphia. Like, these were people who were not well-off, but they were, like I said, solid middle-class folks who were going to disagree with composting next door to them.
Yeah. I've never dealt with compost next to me, so I don't know what that's like. I can't imagine it'd be nice.
It smells terrible. If you've ever been to Georgetown, it smells a lot like that.
No. Well, by 1981, members that remained, they relocated, but they kept up the fight, and they continued to upset their neighbors even after they moved, and comes all the way up to 1985 with a final battle with police. So in May of 1985, after a whole year of police surveillance, the police obtained warrants for four members that lived in the house. Okay, so what they did was May 13, 1985, they tried to evacuate the surrounding neighborhood. 500 cops showed up. Mind you, there are 11 people in this house. 500 cops show up to serve a warrant for four people. And obviously they know that the movement has guns and are able to defend themselves. So they first attempt to evacuate the building using water cannons and tear gas. Obviously a gun battle broke out. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the fire department blasted the house with 1,000 gallons of water a minute for nearly 6 hours. Police responded to Move's gunfire by throwing smoke grenades and firing at least 10,000 rounds of ammunition at the house. That's unbelievable.
Well, what I remember reading was there was a bunker at the top level, like a concrete bunker that the police knew about, and they dropped what is essentially a combat bomb on top of it, and it blew a hole down into it. Now, some of the police officers said there was no fire, but we know for a fact there was a fire burning within the house. So then, according to Move members, they go to leave. The police begin shooting back at the house as they're leaving. Yep. Keep in mind, there are children in this home.
Yep, yep.
Children in this house. And they say they went back of their own accord. Who in the hell is going to run back into a burning building?
Exactly, exactly. Unless we've got some quotes here. Frank Powell, a Philadelphia police officer who, 1985, was the chief of the city's bomb disposal squad, is quoted, you know, later on saying, he getting the call and saying, "Wow, you want me to do what?" And he handed him a green army style satchel. It contained C4 plastic explosives, what they used in Vietnam. He boarded a state police helicopter and took his position, balanced for cautiously on the skids of the aircraft. He's quoted saying he can't remember being scared, but though he must have. And at 5:27 p.m., helicopter rose into a crystal blue sky, carried out the orders. He lined up his sights, lit the 45-second fuse with the military igniter, and followed orders. He said, "I reached out, and I dropped it. Perfect. It was going right where it was supposed to go."
Well, what amazes me is, like, just they evacuated the homes around them, so they knew it was going to be bad. Like, they were aware. But also, did you notice one important point? The mayor is the one that wanted this executed. Did you happen to catch the race of the mayor of Philadelphia at that time?
The first black mayor of Philadelphia, actually.
Third black mayor of Philadelphia.
First black mayor.
Yeah, exactly. First black mayor of Philadelphia. So this is going on his watch. Like, at some point, it comes back to the same thing of, we often think that people are good decision makers, and they're really not. Like, there had to be a better way.
You know? Oh, absolutely.
And I feel like this kind of comes back to the question of, do I agree? And one resident said this. He said, they deserve to be arrested and removed. Mm-hmm. They did not deserve to die.
Exactly.
And I feel like that is a common statement we hear nowadays of, did that person deserve to go to jail? Probably. Exactly. But you do not have the right to become an executioner. Yep. And that, to me, is a point that we keep coming back to, is that I believe in the American justice system. I believe it works. But I have a problem with the idea that that some police officers appear to be playing judge, jury, executioner within a 5-minute period.
Right. Yeah, no, that's certainly not okay. And yeah, I agree with you on that. But they said on the top of the building there were several barrels of gasoline that had been started, and it kick-started a fire. And, you know, one of the things I found most crazy about this is police commissioner, whose name is Greg Samber, told firefighters to stand down, let the fire burn. And as they let the fire burn, they continued to shoot at the house. It's overkill. Like, they clearly didn't want them to come out. And that's what Ramona Africa, one of the few that survived, she and her brother survived together. They asked her, they did an interview of her in 2017, and she's quoted saying, "When we realized that our house was actually on fire, we immediately tried to get our children, animals, and ourselves out the blazing inferno. But at the point we were trying to come out and could be seen, the cops opened fire on us, forcing us to go back in." She said, "We tried several times, but each time we were shot back into the house. This is a clear indication that they didn't intend for us to survive this attack." And that's exactly what that says, is they never wanted or expected them to get out.
Yeah, and I think you and I talked about beforehand, you know, a little pre-interview, we talked about this. This is eerily similar to Waco, and I think 92 or 91? When you really look at this, let's be real. The move movement was a cult. Let's be
honest. Absolutely.
It has all the indications of a cult, okay? Which is exactly what the Branch Davidians were. That being said, and were they, you know, and the thing about Branch Davidians were is that David Koresh was molesting small children. And we all can agree that's a terrible thing and he should have gone to jail for it. Uh-huh. But it also became kind of a badge of honor for the ATF to go in and get the illegal weapons. And that led to the armed conflict that happened there. The difference is that you have a 2 weeks of negotiations in Waco. You have literally no warning for the move bombing in Philadelphia.
Right. And one of the things I found like most interesting was like Waco, you hear about that. That's in textbooks, but move bombing is not. And I started trying to do research to try to figure out why it wasn't. Like, why is this not as more heard of as people should know about it? And I found some research that said that there are people who can identify with Waco and their cult-like, and they said no one can identify with the MOVE movement. And that's why it kind of just, the story just stopped because nobody identifies with that, which I found weird.
I would contend 24-hour news is also a factor.
Okay.
Because in 85, CNN doesn't exist. Thing about Waco was you watched it in real time.
Right.
You saw that building burn in real time. Also, here the difference also is your political that Waco was at the back end of a couple of different things. Ruby Ridge had happened. It's starting to move forward, and you're starting to see white nationalist extremism in the West, which is still very prevalent today. People move out there to become militias. They go out there and they're going to run, very anti-government in the Wyoming, Montana, Texas areas, where you see some of these kind of, for lack of a better term, gun nuts go out there and create their own kind of place. The thing about MOVE is interesting is, again, it's in a major American city.
Yep.
It would be kind of the equivalent of, to me, if the Manson family had been shot in their homes, which instead of taking to that, and not that they're anywhere close to that kind of level of serial killer or anything like that, but that's another cult that, again, and you can point to, you often see people talk about the fact of how come white criminals get taken to jail while black criminals are shot and killed. Charles Manson got arrested in his place as opposed to shot and killed in his home.
Or bombed.
Same argument you hear about. It's the same thing you hear. I mean, it's just like when the Panthers got, when the Panthers got bombed. Same kind of thing. When they, police broke in and shot them in L.A.
It's a real threat.
The experience of even black extremists don't get treated the same way white extremists get treated.
I agree.
And that's a very weird distinction.
People feel more threatened for some reason. And I can't describe why. I really can't. I really can't. Speaking about Wyoming, fun fact, there are more sheep than there are people in the state of Wyoming. So
I was unaware of that.
So zombie apocalypse, you probably want to hit that way. But in the bombing, more than 60 homes were destroyed in the fire and 250 people were left homeless. And we were talking about the mayor, W. Wilson Goode. I think that's how you pronounce his name. He appointed the Philadelphia Special Investigation Commission, and they also called themselves the MOVE Commission, which investigated the events and held weeks of televised public hearings. City officials and local residents all took the stands, though members of the police bomb unit refused to testify. And ironically, or I don't understand why, Ramona Africa also refused to testify. And I don't know if that was out of fear of her life. I didn't find anything about that. The result was in the highly critical report that found dropping a bomb on an occupied row house was unconscionable. Goode later issued an apology, but never were any criminal charges filed, which is unbelievable. That is unbelievable. And I can't even understand why nobody would get criminal charges. Somebody's accountable.
We're going to talk about this in the second segment when I talk about my views on just my experience with police versus, say, yours or anybody else's. But that's another example of why I truthfully believe you cannot trust police to police themselves. I think this is another example of that at some point there's got to be some – we don't trust presidents to police themselves. Independent counsels are used all the time. But yet the only time we trust a body to investigate itself is the police. And it doesn't make sense to me.
I agree. So the results after the fires and the houses burned, 6 adults and 5 children burned to death. The only 2 people to make it out were Ramona Africa and her brother, I can't recall his name right now. I think his name is John Africa, I think, or Frank Africa, one of the two.
Dre, I'm going to need you to step your game up. You're sounding very Perlo Podcast Dr. Ty right here without having to find a name, because that's something we do a lot. We always do that guy that was in that thing. We do that a lot. I expect more out of you right here, man.
I know, and I'm upset because I got both names right here. I just don't see. All right, either way, after it's all said and done, Ramona and her brother escape the house. She grabs her brother. They escape the house. They get out. They get arrested. They go to the hospital. They get up to go from the hospital, and then they go to jail for 7 years. Ramona Africa goes to jail for 7 years. Still add insult to injury because they still like follow through with the warrant that they bought. They came to get Ramona and they got her. And eventually she was able to file a lawsuit. And 1996, 11 years later, the federal court ordered the city to pay $1.5 million judgment to Ramona Africa and the relatives of John and Frank Africa, finding that the city had used excessive force and violated members' constitutional protections against unreasonable search and seizure. The New York Times reported that Ramona was awarded $500,000 total for pain, suffering, as well as disfigurement and the burns she suffered in the fire. That's unbelievable. $500,000. She lost all her friends and was disfigured and burned in fire, lost her house, and still had to go to jail. I can't even fathom that. I can't.
It's amazing. And at least she got something. There's a lot of evidence. There's a lot of instances of people not getting anything.
You're right. You are so right. You're so right. On May 13th of this year, 2020, it was the 35th anniversary of the bombing. 11 Philadelphia City Council members issued a formal apology for what they called a brutal attack carried out by the city of Philadelphia on its own citizens. They quoted saying, "We apologize for the decisions leading to the devastation of that day and acknowledge the fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of the MOVE bombing," the council members said in a joint statement. What's crazy is after all this time and all this trauma, MOVE remains active. And it's still going on. And Africa's son, Junior, has been big in this. Like, he sits down with city councils and he has talked to that mayor who ordered that bombing. And he says, even sitting there with the mayor, he said it makes his stomach turn because, like, he knew those people in that house that they bombed and killed. And he said, it's tough, but he does it. And I didn't do too much research on him, but I think that's a whole nother topic on its own.
That can't be
easy. Oh, that's tough. Gotta be tough. For the murder of a policeman in 1977, after spending 40 years, they're starting to get released. And the first person got released in February of 2020. And I can't even imagine sitting in a jail cell for 40 years knowing that you didn't do it for something that you didn't do. That right there is just also unbelievable. This whole thing is unbelievable. Sometimes they call Philadelphia, or this part of Philadelphia, the city that bombed itself. And it's just unbelievable. It is. But what we're going to do, we're going to take a quick commercial break here from our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll answer some questions that I'm sure our listeners also have. Talking with Dr. Mathis here. And as always, we do have some questions for our guest. And our guest is particularly interested in this topic. And I'm interested in talking to him because we surely don't have our same experiences with the police. And so that's the first question I want to ask you. What is your general experiences with the police?
And this is interesting because I'm a white guy. Police abuse has happened to white people too. Let me state that first off, not near as much as it happens to black folks. Uh-huh. But I've been pulled out of a car before, but mostly it was because I seem jittery because I get nervous. Cause I always were taught that your police stop you is because you did something wrong. Uh-huh. Because I've never had any experience with police pulling me over when I didn't do something wrong. Uh-huh. Now I also am a believer. Like I believe that, in my experience, police have been called when I needed help. Something happened and I needed those kind of things. I've never been harassed by the police. I have a unique experience because, you know, I went to a school, you know, that was majority black school out in the country in South Carolina. And I've known people that when we went places, they would tell me stories, but I've never had a personal experience where I felt like I was harassed for no reason by the police. And I'm sure, but I've heard enough to know that it obviously happens, and much more so than should be happening.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As a black man, I definitely have had, I haven't necessarily had police brutality, but harassment is definitely a real thing. And me particularly, I know that I look the part. Like I, you know, to them, I look like I'm big, I'm black, I got dreads, you know, and I know that in any situation, I'm going to be a target, and I will spend countless amount of money on my car to make sure my registration, my tags is good, my license is always good, because I don't ever want to have no run-ins with the police at any time.
But let me ask you, and this is a thought I had as we were sitting to talk about this, was, is it a self-fulfilling prophecy at this point where maybe I think police are more guarded when they come up to a black suspect? I think that's obvious. But because I think black folks are also nervous about the interaction because they've heard so many horror stories, that it almost amps everything up to 11 on both sides. And that in some ways, it's obviously not their fault. Police should be more professional than that. And so I think we've reached a point where neither side ever trusts anybody. So even if you didn't, there's automatically a tension there that's not there for white suspects. You know, that's always my thing, is the fear for me of police officers of black males is amazing. Like I've never, and when there's no need to be scared, I don't understand. Like, it's obviously a scary job. I get the idea that it's one of the few jobs ever that you could be killed in while doing it. But I also know that the majority of people you stop are not out to harm you. And I don't know why I don't understand it. And it seems to also happen with black police officers, which I feel is an interesting phenomenon also.
Yeah, I can't explain that either. Because I said myself, like at the protests or at the riots, if my job was a police officer, I'm calling in. I'm not going to work. No. Like,
do you feel, all right, if a black cop were to stop you, do you feel more comfortable?
No, not at all.
So it's that's a good point to me, is that it's obviously a systemic police problem, not just black white police problem.
I would hope to get a better treatment, but I wouldn't say it would make me feel more comfortable, because you know, they gonna choose their boys. If it's me or him, they gonna choose them. And that's perfectly evident. Like if it came down to it, he's gonna choose him, like right or wrong. So it definitely still makes me nervous regardless.
That to me is interesting. That's just an interesting phenomenon to me.
Yeah. I definitely interested to hear experiences with the police. Do you think the police are necessary?
Absolutely. There's a certain segment of our population that can't function in society. And I had my car broken into this past month. Mm-hmm. And when I needed somebody to come, because I'm not, here's my thing, I don't want to shoot somebody because I'm not trained to do that. I'm not in that, you know, I'm not trained to investigate those things. And I cannot see a world where there's not a need for somebody who is trained in what is both legal and illegal to come handle a situation. I don't trust citizens to handle that. Like there's people in this world that believes like we ought to have patrols in schools, like armed patrols because of school shootings. Like we ought to have that. And that, I don't trust that. I don't trust Sammy, the former, you know, Marine, to patrol my school with an AR-15. Right. But I do trust my SROs to do a good job. I feel there's a need for police. I think there's always going to be a need for people to enforce the law. But they need to do it better. I will say that.
I agree.
I'll tell you what I believe is. We need a change. 90% of stops, not 90%, a large percentage of stops are based on suspicion of drug activity. Mm-hmm. I think you can honestly trace a lot of our problems here with eliminating the drug war. I'm a big proponent of legalization of all drugs because I don't think
all of them.
I'll tell you why.
Go ahead.
If you choose to put in your body seems to be a personal choice. That to me is a personal choice as an adult. If I decide I want a mainline Lysol, I can do that. You know, as an American, I had that choice. My thing is this, what you choose, if you don't hurt anybody, let's say you're on heroin or I'm on heroin, which is a terrible drug. If I choose to use that and I don't hurt anybody else, where is the harm in that?
But those people always hurt somebody else.
Oh,
no.
Then arrest them for that activity.
So they, okay, I see what you're saying.
If I knock over a 7-Eleven to pay for my habit, then arrest me for knocking over a 7-Eleven. Think about how to start. How does stop and frisk start, Dre? Think about this. It starts because you stop a person who is doing nothing but walking around. And in America, you don't get to ask me where I'm going.
Yeah, that's a terrible idea. Stop and frisk is a terrible idea anyway.
But that's what. But why? But where does stop and frisk come from? It comes from trying to stop from a broken windows theory of if we're proactive policing, by stopping people, we can stop future crimes. To me, it's anti-American because I don't have to show you papers of where I'm going.
Right.
If I decide to take a jog at 4 a.m., by God, I can do that. That's part of my – and there's – the probable cause statutes have gotten so lenient where all you have to do is assume somebody is guilty and you can search them, stop them, and do anything you want to them. And that's a direct line to the drug war because that has become a crime, which is pretty much directly relate – is directly affecting poor people and minorities.
I haven't considered that. I know I've heard you say that before about trying to stop the crime on, I mean, the war on crime because, you know, it's ineffective. It's a losing battle. But I don't know about all drugs.
A friend of ours says he thinks that they ought to make it where the attempt to smuggle drugs in would be illegal. But once they're in the country, nothing you can do about it. It's one of those things where the whole idea and listen, I think drugs can destroy people. I have no doubt about it. But let me ask, you played athletics. How many people do you know that took prescription painkillers, which is nothing more than heroin in a pill form?
Oh, I mean, and that was another thing. Like, so pharmaceuticals who like Percocet, Roxy's and stuff like that you can get from your doctor, like, are you saying that open those up to be freely too? To be done freely too?
I mean, the whole idea, I believe this, it's like the seat, to me, it's the seatbelt law. If I don't want to wear a seatbelt, why is that a separate charge? Why is that a crime if I choose to only harm myself? That is how I feel about it. And my thing is, it's the same thing of, and you can keep following the line. How come you have to have 3 times as much powder cocaine to get the same charge as 1 gram of crack cocaine? That is directly targeted.
That is, yeah.
It's directly targeted at black folks.
I agree. Now, that is definitely because cocaine is a more like white people drug and crack is something that black people sell. Yeah, I agree.
It's the whole thing of if we're going to attack the system, I think I'm against proactive policing. I want to say that now. And what's funny is when New York, when I think Eric Garner?
Yes.
Isn't that his name? The guy who got killed for
selling illegal cigarettes. Mm-hmm.
First of all, can we talk about the fact that if people are selling cigarettes one by one, your cigarette prices are too high. Let's start that first of all. Secondly, okay, that New York police officers chose to stop proactive policing and violent crime reports of violent offenses, rapes, murders, armed robbery, aggravated assault went down.
You said they stopped proactive policing.
Yes, they only responded to calls. They did not go out and actively stop people.
Right.
And reports of those crimes went down. And let's also be honest. Now, crime has gone down since the 90s. Right now, we are at one of the lowest points in crime of all time.
Well, it's super easy to get caught now. Everything's on film.
If you look at the numbers, the only crime, and this is sad, the only crime that has gone up is rape. And the reason of that is because women now report it. We are in a time now where women are much more likely to report rapes than they ever have been. The whole thing comes back to, I believe, again, I don't see the need for the idea. I watch Live PD. I love Live PD. I'm going to tell you now, the fact that it's off bothers me. I loved watching Live PD. What's funny is I've had people I taught that were running from the police like a bunch of idiots. which is what, and it could have hurt somebody else. And that's why I think, but my thing comes back to the majority of people, they stop and they pull out of that car. They smell weed. They pull them out. They search them. And there's always weed in the car every daggum time. It's all based on drug crime. And the whole thing comes back to, like, if you own, but I also saw them stop a man and a woman walking down the road. They had done nothing but walk down the road. They stopped them, asked them where they were going. They searched them for no other reason than supposedly they had matched the description.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That, and what does that sound like? It sounds like what happened in Louisville. They had the wrong name, and that girl died because they had the wrong description. I'm against no-knock warrants. I think you ought to have to
identify. Oh, yeah, that's ridiculous.
Although they get all gunned up, you got to police officers. This is accidental shootings that happen far too often to let that continue to happen. There's got to be some – I'm all about changing in police power. I'm about changing police policy, but not about getting rid of them all together.
I think they need to be restructured. I definitely do. And
what does that mean?
So this – and it brings it to the next question – because some places in the nation are replacing what would be police responders with trained professionals. For example, in a domestic violence call, instead of getting, you know, 3-4 cops, you get social workers who can help, or, you know, psychologists, or, you know, people who are not going to come armed and escalate a situation that could be talked through, maybe.
Okay. But at the end of that day, does that guy who hit that woman, does he go to jail?
If he hit her, yeah. So when I say domestic violence, I can say your neighbor calls and they hear yelling next door and you're in an argument with your wife. Now, if the police show up, you know, 9 times out of 10, they take that guy away regardless of whether he hit her or not. But you bring in a psychologist or you bring in a therapist or you bring a consultant to sit down, you know, and that changes the dynamics of the relationship. And I had this conversation with our good friend from the Perlo podcast, you know, Shane, whatever. And I said, if we come to a peaceful negotiation, what I believe is a peaceful negotiation, and we sit down and you put a gun on the table, you've changed the dynamics of this relationship. Like, sure, now sure. I feel like you think I'm a threat. So now I'm threatened by you. And that creates a whole lot of tension that doesn't need to be there. And that's something that a social worker or, you know, a psychologist, somebody brings that they don't bring that, is what I mean. They don't bring that tension into it.
What happens, though, is, and here's devil, and I hate devil's advocate because you feel like you're attacking somebody. Let me say this now. Uh-huh. Dre and I are very good friends and have these same conversations on text messages back and forth each other all the time. Uh-huh. So my question comes back to this. You show up, domestic violence call, neighbors heard argument. I show up, girl's got a black eye. What happens at that point? The social worker then call the police to come arrest the man who hit the girl? What is the depth to that?
She can. I would say she can. And this is another thing that I don't understand this, or I don't necessarily know all the ins and outs of this, is if I have your address, I have the evidence, I got your license, I got your license plate, you can't get away from me. You know, I don't have to, you know, tase you and shoot you right now to stop you. If you run away, don't worry, I have your address. You got to come home. You know, now that I know your family, I know where you can go, and I can pick you up someplace else. I don't have to shoot you to stop you. I don't have to tase you. I don't have to beat you. I don't have to choke you, okay? You want to run away? Say less, fam. You can't outrun my radio.
Yeah.
And that's another situation.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I would say this, about like high-speed chases. At some point, you going 100 miles down the road, 100 miles an hour down the road, chasing somebody going 100 miles an hour down the road, if you already have his license plate number, you take the chance of hitting somebody who is innocent and killing
exactly.
them. And what's
exactly.
funny is a lot of precincts now will not chase, unless it's a violent offense, they will not chase a motorcycle because there's too much chance of killing either somebody innocent or that person. There's no way to spike strip a bike. You can't do right. that. So right. I'm with you too. The question always comes down to what crimes are you willing to chase somebody versus what crimes are you not willing to chase somebody? That seems to be kind of
Is the person armed and dangerous at the moment? If the person is armed and dangerous at the moment, then this requires a person who has had extensive training with a gun, with de-escalation, with negotiation tactics. This is what that calls for.
I'm a big proponent of, first of all, I think that we don't do enough psychological testing on our police officers. I think there's not enough of that. My good friend, the Colonel, has talked about the fact of that there's a lot of people with existing, if you look at like they were, a lot of people get psyched out that are not allowed into our military who then become police officers because they could not pass psychological tests. Mm-hmm. But I would contend also is that sort of like we have bad teachers in this world, is that the money that we spend using doing other things, and I know we're coming around eventually to the whole defund the police idea. Mm-hmm. I think that's a poor word. I think defund is a bad word because defund sounds like no police. And I've told you, I'm not okay with that because if my family is in danger, I want to be able to call trained people to come make sure my family is safe. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest with you, you don't really want me making that decision either. Not somebody who's got skin in the game. You know what I'm saying? Like, you really don't want me making that choice. But I think demilitarize is a great point. I think the idea of, I don't think that police stations and municipalities need tanks. I don't think that, like, some of the, what I've seen in some of these protests, these damn armored vehicles, it's absolutely insane, man. And the cost isn't worth it.
I agree.
I did notice, I think you sent me a couple things. I think we've got to change the rules of engagement. I think that's got to happen. I think the idea that you don't, that supposedly in some cases, you don't have to announce that you're going to shoot before you shoot, which is amazing.
Yeah. We talked about the, they came out with a, and there was two different programs for the NAACP, the 8 that can't wait and the NAACP did for. And when I read through these, I'm looking like, I can't believe that these are not rules already.
And I can't believe you don't have, that in some places you don't have to report the uses of force. I find that to be amazing. I feel like if you put your hands on somebody else, you should have to report that to your superior.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm a real believer in civilian councils. I think there needs to be an independent body outside of the police station mm-hmm. that looks at all police shootings. I think that's required. You know, it's, I think there, like I said, we've got to admit, first thing is you have to admit there's a problem. And I don't see how anybody does not look at statistics and doesn't look at the things that have happened and say there is not a disconnect between what police say they want to happen in the community versus what is actually happening.
Right.
And that seems to be my issue.
And we talked about defunding and demilitarizing. When you say demilitarize, I think that's a part of defunding. You're saying take that money that you spent on that tank and, you know, put it towards more training. In my opinion, and I don't know very many police officers, I know a few, but in all the research that I've looked at, not in one instance has a police officer, you know, got done and said, I was glad I had my M16 today. You know, you don't need those.
Well, and if they did, it's for things that they have special units for. For example, if somebody, when the Northern California bank robbery, when those guys basically have like body armor, the first original North Hollywood shooting, they had, you know, they brought out bigger guns for somebody who was robbing a bank who had guns. I mean, it was a straight up shootout. That's what mm-hmm. it was. I think you need those. The problem also, and this happens in a lot of different police officers, your best police officers don't stay in uniform, if that makes any sense.
Become detectives, you say?
They move up. So the people who are walking your beat every day, those aren't your best and brightest all the time. Those are your guys who don't move up. And just like we had this conversation as teachers, what happens to your best teachers in schools?
Yeah.
Who do they teach? They teach your top level kids or they become administrators. So your lower level kids end up getting a lesser teacher. They get one with less experience. So my thing is there might need to be a look at the idea of having so-called senior members of police officers who understand about the best police officers I know are people who know how to talk to people.
I agree.
And get a desired result. And so to me, that is what I think we're missing. Is there a time for physicalness? I think so. Or for physicality? I don't believe that you have the right to fight the cop. I just don't. I don't.
I disagree with that. Really? I do. I disagree with that. I feel like, because I've seen people in situations. So I'll tell you this story about me. So one time, I'm young. I'm like 13. I'm at an amusement park, the fair and whatnot. And these people get into an argument. I'll say it's one of my friends get into an argument with somebody. And it escalates. I'm like, man, let's go. We leaving out here. The police is coming over there. In a separate incident, simultaneously, a separate incident, two other groups of people get into an argument on our way out. And I get grabbed. Exactly. That's all. And I'm guilty by association because I look the part. And I get grabbed. So in that instance, my first response is to, lady, get off of me. And, you know, she threatened to pepper spray me, and I was like, that doesn't sound so great. Said, I'll ride this out, you know. And they put me in handcuffs, and I'm 12, 13. Mom had to come get me. She was super upset because she had warned me about these type of incidents for my entire life.
Yeah, and that seems, trust me, I know enough rednecks in this world that decide to fight the police. They get put down much the same way. But again, my thing is though, once you started to get eat, and I hate to say this, even if you're wrong, but the reality is that I don't know in those situations, if let's say a huge brawl breaks out at some party you're at, or I break out, you know, do they have time to figure out who is involved and who isn't? And at the same time, they must protect themselves. I don't know. I do know this. And I'm going to say this now. If you can't get behind the idea that somebody that's standing on somebody's neck for 7 minutes is wrong.
Oh, that, yeah.
Then, and that's what I come back. And this is what we talked about kind of earlier was, do I think that George Floyd broke a law but when he got arrested? Probably. I think he forged a check is what I'd heard. But did he deserve to get his neck stepped on for 7 minutes? Absolutely not.
No.
You know, that comes down to this, if you're going to arrest someone, first of all, the fact that people keep getting away from multiple cops tells you how bad they are at locking down criminals. Like, that's what's amazing to me is, like, kind of what happened in Atlanta. That dude was in his car drunk, and you let him sling off four of y'all. Like, how are you not able to subdue somebody with four people? Like, and why are tasers so easy to grab? I don't understand. Like, it was seen to me like all these things.
They're not good at the jobs.
Yeah, like, there are some jobs you can't mess up in. I think Chris Rock said it best. We don't just shrug it off when, like, if 5% of pilots put their planes in mountains, we wouldn't go, well, it's really hard to be a pilot. We wouldn't say that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it would be, we would understand that it is realistically messing up is not okay.
And that's a big thing that is really sparked the protests and riots and the anger and the fury is there is very little accountability.
Yep.
Very little.
And that goes back to my belief in needing independent counsels is a real belief of that not enough people have been held accountable for their poor decisions.
Right. Right. That's huge. And that's what infuriates me because I know if I have any run-ins with a cop, there's going to be nobody responsible. Like nobody's going to have that accountability. The same way we talked about with Move, like there were no arrests, no convictions. There was nothing. Like nobody was deemed responsible for the deaths of children. And that's not okay.
And there comes a point at which you have to ask the question of why are, you know, it's time for people who are supposedly the good cops to make decisions that are smarter to say, you got to stop doing what you're doing. Like mm-hmm. within themselves, in the George Floyd situation, why did four grown adults, nobody said, get off of that guy. He's already down.
Right.
Like And I've watched, once again, I watch live PD religiously, and I've seen them. They use that same hold, the knee in the back, to put somebody in handcuffs. Once they're in handcuffs, it's over.
I agree.
Like, you force them in the car, they'll stop. You stop enough fights in your career as an educator to know. They'll stop fighting. Eventually, they stop. Yeah. And you can't run with your hands behind your back.
I agree.
It comes down to
it's a power move. I have power over you.
It's absolutely that way. And there's a lot, and there are many police officers who do that job to hold power over other people.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer of there. I think there's a silent majority, and it's got to stop being silent, of police officers who want to be good at their job, who want to do the right thing, but they're way too silent. And until they stop being silent, it's on us, the citizens, to say something's got to change.
Right. So do you have an opinion on what should happen if someone dies due to police brutality and in police care?
I mean, your response at the point you take them into custody, they're your responsibility. Much the same way as if a child is in my school, in my classroom, that child is my responsibility.
And that's the thing.
Yeah, that is. Once you've taken, it's kind of how I feel about prisons also. And I also understand, like, people who get stabbed by other prisoners in prison and then nobody in the prison is held accountable. Like, if you're going to take away somebody's freedom, you are saying I am now in charge of you.
Yeah.
So how are you not responsible for what happens to those people within your care?
I agree.
And when you arrest somebody, technically they're in your care. I feel like that's something that that is not being taken into consideration. Yeah,
I agree. Because if a kid gets injured in my classroom, I am held accountable. You know, before the end of the day, I am at the district office, I'm fired, I'm all this and that. So
even if it's not your fault, if a fight were to break out in your classroom and a kid were to get hurt, it's on you, not on the kid who hurt them. And you know, that seems to be the problem. Again, you don't. And I think this is I hate to say I understand, because I'm a real believer and I will never as a white man understand what it's like to be black, but I do feel like I can empathize with black people when they say they don't feel like enough's being done.
And yeah, I think, because it's certainly not. It is.
I feel like the thing is, you don't trust the system because the system's turned your back on you so much.
Oh yeah. I've been in, which brings me to the next question. What are your feelings about calling the police? You said you would.
I call the police. If I feel like somebody's broken the law against me, I call the police. Now, I will say this. The whole, I hate to say Karen, because I have an Aunt Karen who's a very nice lady. but the whole like, you know, Karen phenomenon of you're black, you're making me uncomfortable, I call the police.
That happens a lot.
That's a false police report. And it should be prosecuted as such. You know, I feel like that there's a phenomenon where if you do something I don't like, and it's not illegal, and I know it's not illegal, I just don't like you, I can call the police on you. That should be a crime. And it is a crime on the books. Nobody just prosecuted. I do call the police. If something happens in my home or something happens around me that I feel is illegal, I call the police. I never think twice about it. Never.
See, that's the thing. Before I call the police, I have to assess the entire situation. Like, I have to really look at what's going on, and I have to really factor in, is this worth it? What would happen if I call the police? I tell you, there was my car got sideswiped a couple weeks ago in a hit and run. And before I called the police, I made sure that somebody else saw it. I made sure that there were other people outside when the police came. I made sure that there were other people to talk to, because I just didn't feel comfortable in that one-on-one situation. That's growing up, there was many times where I lived at where nobody called the police, because calling the police could have been a worse outcome than, you know, solving it between the community.
Yep. And that's a recipe for disaster, because then you get into what, for lack of a better term, is vigilante justice of I'll handle it myself. And then there's no jury. There's no due process. There's none of that taking place. And that's anarchy at that point. And it's a shame that it happens that way. There should never be a time where an American citizen fears calling a law enforcement officer to handle if your house got broken into, you should be able to call someone who can hold people accountable who breaks into your place, into your home.
Yeah.
And not worry about, are they going to investigate you because you've done nothing wrong at that point.
See, I think I'd have to think about that too, because my first thought would be like, somebody broke into my house, what'd they steal? You know, you know, if they stole something light, then I might say, change the locks, get up the security, you know, let it go. But if they stole something, you know, very necessary, expensive, or trashed the house, then I might call the police, because I've seen situations to where people called the police and the people who called the police end up being arrested. Have you seen that video of the store owner who called the police because somebody broke their window and they arrested the store owner?
Yeah, that's absolutely insane. Why are you checking all those things? Why are you not taking the complaint from the citizen to make those decisions? I don't know what the answer is. And I'll be the first to tell you, I am not here to tell anybody what we should do, because again, this is something that it didn't happen. It didn't start yesterday, and it's not going to be solved today.
Right.
but it's a conversation that needs to happen. And I also say, we talk about this all the time, it's not going to happen without the help of both the larger majority, the black folks and white folks have to come together. Because just from a simple, you always hear about the vote phenomenon. You got to vote, you see people out and do this. There's not enough black votes in America to outvote. If you vote in racial blocks, it's 61% to 13.
Yep.
We've got to have some, there've got to be some common sense ideas that have been set forth, and admitting there's problems and having conversations that are hard on both sides to get people to agree on what's simple human rights.
I agree. And I feel like sometimes in the government, policy overrides common sense. And that's a terrible situation. So do you think that someone should be held accountable? We talked about the Karens. For example, have you seen I'm sure you saw the lady in New York who called and sounded in distress about the black guy who was bird watching. Have you seen that?
Yeah, she should be arrested for
that. Should she be accountable as an accomplice? Because if she wanted to happen, like if what had happened, what she wanted to happen, then, you know, ain't no telling what happened to that guy. And she would have went on home and moseyed on about her day and felt like the most powerful person in the world.
No question. Because what it comes down to is that you have at that point, you know what you're doing. You know, that lady knew what she was doing at the time. She knew if police were to, when police showed up, she was going to get assumed to be the victim. He was going to be assumed to be the aggressor. Mm-hmm. And now we have a problem. It's a false report. You have committed a crime. And if that crime leads to a further crime, that is, you are then
accountable
for the larger crime. It absolutely should be. We have got to get past the idea that being black in America is a crime and that you're automatically guilty because you are black. And I think there are people out there that really believe that. And it's an interesting phenomenon. And it happens in the South a lot. And I talk about it. You know, people will say all the time, well, I'm not racist. They say it a lot. Mm-hmm. But what I say is they like the black people they know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't trust black people as a culture.
Oh, I get that. I get that a ton. You know, like if I didn't know you, I'd cross the street if I saw you walk down the street the other way.
How much do you hear? Well, not you, Dre.
A ton. Oh yeah.
They make a generalization about culture, and then they say, "But you're not like the rest of them." That's not okay.
Because
what's larger is that you don't know. You really don't know. Black folks, as white folks, are not a monolith. You are not, all black folks don't feel the same way about all things.
You know, I agree.
What's interesting to me is most of the black people I know really want to be treated with respect, want to have the opportunities that everybody else has, and want to simply just do what every other American does and not have to worry about it.
I agree.
And so,
good. Yeah,
I also think though, but I do think there's also a faction, and you're seeing it now where you carry it past common sense things into things that seem like they're taking your eye off the ball of those ideas you want. You know, I don't know that some of the things you're seeing of, I hate to say, and I think Confederate flags ought to be gone from everything. I really do. I don't know that pulling down George Washington statues is really going to hit the points you want to hit. I know that that those ideas are a problem. I know that they're trying to take the word plantation off a lot of subdivisions.
That's the thing. Like my aunts and uncles who came down here and visited was like, where could we stay? I'm like, so-and-so plantation. And they're like, absolutely not. They would never stay on a place that says that.
Yeah, and I look at like, I know people are taking it. And then the worst part is then people take it to the nth degree of saying they're going to bulldoze Boone Hall, you know, and my thing is, though, you're also bulldozing that history of the black folks, the ancestors that lived there. And I don't know. I do think that we need to take – I'm going to be real with you. I'm a Confederate statue pull-down guy. I don't know Absolutely. That we – because here's the thing. Those statues weren't put up after the Civil War. They were put up in the 60s, just after the Civil Rights Movement. If you really look at it, like it's like the Confederate flag at the State House. That got put up in response to the Civil Rights Movement, not in response to the Civil War. You know, it's – those things don't have any place now. You know, I'm not, I think political correctness has a definite place in America. We need to have those discussions about how people feel. I just don't know that if you bulldoze everything, how that's going
to
work.
I know. I had a friend in high school who used to wear a Confederate flag hat all the time. And I said, why do you wear that? Do you understand what that means? You know, and he's a white dude, and our high school, I could probably tell you, memorize every name, phone number, address of every white person in the school. And he was like, no, he's like, he was a real nice dude. He was like, it's not hate, it's heritage. And, and we're in high school, and I explained to you, well, your heritage is hate. And he had never been kicked. That had never been told to him that way. And
it's like people who are trying to convince you that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. Well, that's an absolute lie.
Yeah, I agree.
It absolutely was. And what's funny is people who tell you that they know better. They're telling you that because it's a way of getting around it. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got to come up with, again, common sense solutions in policy that makes sense, that simply say, once again, there is a problem. How are we going to solve this problem? And then go from there. But it got to start from a place of get the divide of, conservative, liberal, get that out of your mind and get it into a human rights perspective of Black folks deserve to live and deserve to have the same opportunities as every other American. Mm-hmm. And so have those conversations among people and be willing to listen. I think another problem is people don't listen. People start with, I want to give you my perspective and not ever be willing to look at one side or the other.
And this is a little off topic, but when you say that people need to listen, that's something that, everybody can agree on. But I feel like there, and me and my girlfriend have this argument all the time. Whose responsibility is it to explain it to white people? Sure. Is it white people's responsibility or is it a Black person's responsibility to explain?
I don't know. I think you have to listen to people. In the sense of, I think you have to have a conversation with Black folks you don't necessarily know or might not agree with. I think that's part of it. Mm-hmm. I think you listen to, and this is always tough on a podcast because you feel like you want to fill the silence. You got to think about it ahead of time. But the truth is that white folks have to talk to each other about it. I think, it's funny. We had this conversation on Dr. Ty and the Colonel, and, we're two white guys. And it doesn't directly affect us in the sense of, we don't have the same experiences. But until you start talking to each other within your racial group about it, I don't think you really can try to get your head around,
And I agree. I think these conversations need to happen everywhere across it. And again, I grew up all Black area, all Black high school. But then I went to a 95% white college. And that's when I realized that, some white people really have no clue. They really have no idea about the racism and prejudice that goes on. I remember some of my white friends saying, hey, let's go to this place. And I'm like, nah, I can't go there. And they're like, why not? Come on, you can go. Let's say, come on, what do you mean? And they really don't understand. And I have to explain to them, this is why,
I have a great story. I hate to use them as an example because it's not their job. My two older brothers are adopted. And they're Black. They played for my father and moved into my house before I was born. And I always wonder why one of my brothers went in a store would give his stuff from another store to the cashier to keep behind the counter. And I never understood why. Oh, and then it's because he was concerned that somebody would thought he was putting stuff into the bag, because they automatically thought he was there to steal. Yep. And until I got older, it never crossed my mind as to why. But I understand that now, that there are people out there that believe when a Black person walks into their store, they're there to rob them. Like they really do. And I also think it's harder in the South because in the South, if you ever crossed the Mississippi, we talked about this. There are no Black folks in the great, once you cross the Mississippi pretty much. Mm-hmm. It's a very white, it's very, when you look at demographics, is that the South is the one place where you have white folks and Black folks really intermingled in rural areas. Learning to live together in those places, you have to find a way to talk to each other with take some of the vitriol out of it and try to have meaningful conversations without the anger. And that amazes me too, is why is the anger at people as opposed to trying to find a solution. And I get why black folks are angry. The white folks being angry is what I don't understand.
I think they feel as if it's a threat to their self-interest. Or I feel like this too. I feel like that I wrote down a response to people like who would say things like all lives matter. And it goes for the most part is, I understand that you feel left out and you don't appreciate that. But, and I think that's what a big part of it is like, you know, people think, yo, I go through hard stuff too. It's not just all about you because they feel left out.
Well, it's kind of like people who don't understand. I always talk about white privilege. I always hear about that. And the thing about white privilege, and I think people don't pay attention to what it really means. Because a lot of people feel like they didn't, a lot of white people feel they have not received privilege. Like they didn't get anything for being white. But it's not about what you get. It's about what you don't have to worry about.
Right.
Like that to me is what it is. Like to me, I've never had to worry about if I left at night, would I get home? That's never been a concern of mine. I never had to worry about if a policeman stopped me, what would he think I was automatically guilty of something?
Yeah.
That is a privilege that you get. And it's a real thing. I don't think I got anything because I was white, but I do think my life in general was easier than if I had been black, born into the same circumstances.
I say you're exactly right, because I have to make conscious decisions, and this topic is for another podcast. So I'm realizing about this stuff as I grow older, I do more research and I read more, is I have to make conscious decisions on how to navigate white space, because that's the world I live in. And I guess that's something that white people don't have to think about. Like when I go running in places, and especially in the area where I live now, that's predominantly white, I have to be conscious about what I wear and where I go.
Well, coded language is a big thing for me. We talk about it all the time. The idea of you never heard a white person described as articulate, ever, not one time in your life. Hmm. But if you ever have like an interview that say he's really articulate, guarantee you're talking about a black guy every time.
Oh, I get that all the time. You're so well spoken.
Yeah, or you talk like you're white. You hear that. And the thing is, why would you? First of all, we all speak English. You know what I'm saying? Like it is what it is. I mean, it's. And I also hate that statement. First of all, I'm very anti-cliche, and I realize I'm saying those more and more, but I hate that. You know, I think it's one of those situations where we've got to get past that and just accept people for people. But also, I disagree with being colorblind. I think that – I hear people say they don't see color, and I think that's incorrect too, because that – to me, that takes away part of who you are. Because you say what you want to. Part of what makes you the person you are is you're a black man. Part of what makes me who I am is I'm a white man. You know, do I respect you any less? Absolutely not. But to say like, I don't see him as this, that's not, I'm discounting part of what makes you who you are.
I remember one of my first days in college, I met a guy and his name is Steve Spence. He ended up being my roommate. He's a white dude. And on the first day I met him, he came up to me and somebody said something about black people. He got upset, visibly upset. He said, come on now. He said, look, I was brought up, I see friends and I see enemies. And everybody's a friend until they make themselves an enemy. And from that moment on, like, I respect him so much. I said, that's a great way to view things. And I had never thought about that. And he didn't discredit color, but he said, that's not what he focuses on. Is he focuses on, you know, friends and enemies. And I like that.
I heard one of your guests talk about the idea of what it was like. I think she was born and I think she lived during like the 50s. And talk about, and my thing is, if you discount what it meant to be a black person during those times, I think you're taking away a lot of the courageous things that happened then.
Oh, I respect them so much. And all my guests have been black women intentionally. That is an intentional thing. Like, you're the first guy I've had on here because black women's voices, I feel like, need to be amplified so much more.
It is. And it's got, like I said, it's amazing. I read something the other day. Somebody said, we act like it was so long ago. You know, you shouldn't. It's so long ago that all these things happened. The civil rights movement was 50 years ago. Like, it's not that long. It's not, we're going through, and I'll say this too, we're going through growing pains as a nation right now. Like, we really are. Like, it's really who we, and I also don't like the fact that I've seen something along the lines of, don't think, you know, somebody said, don't think I'm my ancestors because I was a black guy on Facebook. Don't think I'm my ancestors. I'll throw hands. My thing is, though, that almost seems disrespectful to those people who went through that, because here's today. Today, you have a fighting chance to do something like that. Uh-huh. If a black man were to hit a white man in 1950, it would be a murder trial. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the courageousness of people. Put those people during that particular movement, you talk about putting it on the line, you were playing with your very life at that
point. Oh yeah. When I go to protests, I can't imagine, you know, I'm out there in my, you know, shirt and shorts, protesting and screaming, and those people out there fully dressed, and they're out there all day. You know, they gonna do this all day until they see justice, until they see fit. They're gonna do it all day. They're gonna do it every day. So I respect that and them so much, because they, you know, well, they paved the way for all this.
And the difference is now, like, there are police protection for protests. Like, there are people making sure nobody come. Back then, police were actively stopping protests. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been some movement in a positive direction, but not enough and not fast enough.
Indeed. All right, so we're going to finish these last few questions. Regarding Black history, what do you consider the most significant event in your lifetime?
Regarding Black history?
Uh-huh.
Oh, man, that's very difficult. Wow. This is so hard. I'm trying to find something that's not sports. I'm going to tell you the truth, man. Electing a Black president, I think that, to me, I never thought I would see it in my lifetime.
Okay.
I did not think there was enough white votes out there, because you could not elect Barack Obama, could not get elected with just the black vote. Yeah. There had to be enough white people to vote for him to push him across the line. And I did not think that I would see that, because I still thought there was enough distrust in America to not allow that.
Yeah. And I think it's important that, you know, everybody has a significant moment of Black history. Everybody has to. Who is the most influential person in your life, and why?
In my life, my father, probably. And my parents, and probably both my parents are there, because my parents in general, bro, they're educators for 42 years. And my parents honestly had every opportunity. And, you know, like I said, they took kids in. There have been 8 people who have lived in my house who were not related to me. You know, and they want to learn, and they're compassionate people. You know, and, you know, my dad told me a long time ago, because they've dealt with racial things their entire life. You know, they've had to, because of being part of the South, you know, my dad's whole thing was, you treat people well, but you respect their culture, and you treat people who they are and where they are, and you work with them. And, you know, everybody wants to be treated well. And that's just really what you try to do.
I agree. Is there anything else you want to add?
I'm sure there'll be people who disagree with me, and if you do, I totally respect that. I'm always down for a conversation.
Absolutely. I talk with you the most probably about all this. I go with you, talk with you, and I talk to Shane from the Perlow podcast a lot about all this. I do, a ton.
Yeah, and I think those conversations, I think conversations need to happen. The big thing is just remember to respect people in the conversation.
Absolutely.
I'll tell you something else too. This is indeed, I think podcasts are interesting to do for these kind of conversations, because it gives you a back and forth. And it gives you a chance to explain yourself you might not could do with the written word.
I agree. But thank you, Dr. Mathis. If you'd like to reach out to us and give us ideas for the podcast, tell us ways we can improve, make a correction in the research, please feel free to email us at bhshortstories@gmail.com. That's B as in Black, H as in history, and short stories, plural. See you guys next week. Thank you.